From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, I speak with Jaron Lanier, visionary computer scientist, composer, and visual artist. He tells us you are not a gadget.
Hello, I'm Jason Ponton, the editor-in-chief of Technology Review, MIT's magazine that focuses on the future of technology. We're proud to underwrite Tech Nation. Our award-winning magazine features cutting-edge articles, and breaking tech news appears every day at technologyreview.com.
In the preface to his book, Jaron Lanier writes, "The words in this book are written for people, not computers."
Yeah, we got this nutty idea about 10 years ago that instead of words being written down for people, perhaps even as part of making a living, instead the idea is that the words are maybe originated in people, but we try to ignore the people. We try to make the people invisible. And instead, all the words are aggregated together by big machines. And the purpose is to analyze how people like the words so that you can send ads to those people. So everything becomes this depersonalized mush that's in the service of advertising. And that would be okay, you know, if we're really confident that out into the future we'll always have something to advertise so that there's some way to keep on this human experiment we've been having. But it seems to me it's a self-limiting process, like a snake eating its own tail, that this way of using words where we just have machines mash them up in order to manipulate us can't go on forever. It's only a thing we can keep going for a little while, and then we have to do something else.
What struck me when I read that was this big light bulb that said it used to be. I got a whole lot of books, a whole lot of novels, and a lot of them were interesting and relevant to technology and biotech and every science, everything else we talk about. And you could tell when the person wrote the novel to be a movie. You could just tell. It was right there. This is okay, and then we changed scenes, yeah. And then, you know, special effects. And now there is this writing to make sure that the right keywords are in there and that the right connects to. It's like, wait a minute, are you talking to the person reading this, or are you talking to the bot that's going to try to grab people to? I mean, you can't serve multiple mediums. We've always known that.
Yeah. Well, I have a book that ridicules, in a sense, this sort of tendency to turn life into a string of keywords for the service of somebody else's ad. And it presents a dilemma because a lot of the folks who'd like me to promote the book want me to
do
tweet
just that
or whatever. And I'm just going to see if maybe the book on the own, based on no other merit than what it says, is going to attract people. I'm going to see if that still works.
The old-fashioned way.
Yeah, maybe a little bit of substance still means something.
The first target of your look at the digital revolution, of course, is the World Wide Web, specifically those constructs which arose around the turn of the millennium, the frequently referred to as Web 2.0, the so-called second generation of the web. What's the hype of 2.0 from your perspective, and what's the truth about 2.0?
There's one beautiful truth. And that's something that came up in the 90s, which is it actually does turn out that vast numbers of people want to be active, want to be expressive. And this is something that might just sound normal now, but you have to remember that if you go back to the 80s, let's say, everyone was telling me and the other idealists of that era, everybody wants to be a couch potato in front of the TV. People want to be dull consumers. They don't want to say a word. They want to sit there like lumps, and that's who they are, that's who we are, and that's it forever for humanity. And we were all saying, no. People want to communicate, they want to connect, they want to be creative, they want to be active, they want to do things. And it turns out that was true, which is amazing. Now, the problem is that people just did that on a volunteer basis, so there wasn't any business there exactly. So some people just went with that and said, well, okay, let's just not make a big business empire. And a great example is Craig of Craigslist. He said, okay, fine, we'll just do classified ads without building a giant thing. He could have built a Google and didn't. And that was sort of one spirit of the time.
He had to be talked into classified ad. He just wanted to share, have people do good things for each other.
So that's very reflective of that earlier spirit. And then, like, all these people came in, oh, wait a second, we can use this all to sell advertising. It'll be even bigger than TV advertising. And some of us went, oh, no, no, Sergey, don't do it. No. But anyway, that's what happened. And It's just not sustainable and it's not dignified. And I know what I'm saying is terribly unpopular and it's not what people want to hear right now. And sometimes I think that there's sort of a lost generation that just wants to live in the service of ads and hype and nonsense, but maybe their children will turn it around. I don't know. I sometimes think I'm writing for the children of the Facebook generation who aren't born yet, because there's just this madness right now, this mass hypnosis about trivial nonsense. I mean, I just can't believe that we're in this recession and we're at two wars. We're not creating an industry, and instead we're amusing ourselves with stupid tweets, and somehow that's supposed to be productivity. It's not. It's terrible. This is where I just feel disconnected from a lot of folks these days, and I just can't see how they could possibly be right.
I'm fascinated by or attracted, if you will, by the use of the word dignified. None of it's dignified.
Yeah, I think this concept of dignity is an important one. I think one aspect of dignity is that you should be able to be a person, meaning that if you do something, you make a video, you write something down, it should be part of who you are. People should know you. It shouldn't be anonymized. It shouldn't become part of this mashup where you have no influence over the context in which people perceive it. You should have some kind of connection to it so that it can still mean something instead of just becoming a bunch of gradually more and more random bits. And then another part of making a living, another part of dignity is making a living. This new concept of everything being free and open means that people have to sing for their supper for every single meal. So instead of just being able to write a book and earn some royalties from it, you're supposed to go out and lecture. That sounds great when you're 20, but try being a parent. Try being somebody who's aging. Try being somebody who has a family where somebody's ill. I mean, just real life doesn't work that way. And here, to me, that desire, I mean, it's totally natural to want to be eternally young and to pretend to be young. I call it youthiness in the book, in honor of truthiness.
Yeah.
But
you'll be the word next year. Stephen Colbert did the first year he came out.
So youthiness. But it's also just this desire to try to escape the problems of being biological at all. People want to think of themselves as being abstract eternal machines, and this is a way to have that fantasy. It's like the way teenagers desire to be vampires sometimes, to be eternal and not to have to face death and aging, and it's a natural fantasy, but we're letting it get in the way of life. It's the wrong trade-off.
Well, going on to that, you know, should you give it away for free or not? In the early days of the web, you wrote another manifesto, Piracy is Your Friend.
Yes.
Now you say you were wrong.
I know.
What was your original premise and what did you get wrong?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the people who are criticizing my book now, and I know a lot of folks really dislike it.
Which is why we had you on.
Yeah.
No, that's not why we had you on, Jerry.
I mean, the funny thing is I actually did help make up a lot of this stuff. And a lot of the particular talking points that are part of the open culture movement are actually things I made up long ago. Not that it matters. And you know why? It's just because it seemed possible. There was a certain moment when it looked like things might click together. And I'll tell you what really turned me around is this very simple thing called empiricism. It's actually being an engineer and observing results and seeing if something's working. And you can only go on ideology for so long. I mean, we've had Web 2.0 for 10 years. We've had the web for it'll be pretty soon. It'll be two decades, you know, and it's enough time to get results. And if you're not willing to look at the results, you're not being rational. And it's just so overwhelmingly clear what a disaster this whole direction's been. So yes, I did make up some of the stuff. I'm sorry. But, you know, the main thing is to respond to actual data, to look at results and be willing to respond. I mean, having a bad hypothesis is forgivable. Ignoring data is not forgivable.
Well, as Craig Newmark himself says, I love newspapers. Part of my Craigslist has put newspapers out of business. I don't know how to reconcile it other than I didn't intend for any of this to happen. And the classified ads, they actually fund the ability for all these other people to do all this stuff for free, which is good for society.
Yeah. Well,
it's tough.
See, there were two streams of thought, if you go back to then, that made me at least feel like what Craig was doing was fine. One was the Ted Nelson stream of thought that eventually there'll be genuinely universal micropayments, so people will actually pay for the news story instead of the classified ad in the newspaper, so therefore you won't
need. You read five stories, five micropayments. You read 500 micropayments. But it's all somehow there's money and value transpiring here. Somebody has to pay the bill.
Yeah. Well, see, I think that America is lost in a sort of a dreamland right now, where each in our own ways, what we want to do is what I call being the most meta, to own the most central node on some network. It might be the most central node on a financial network, so you can run the hedge fund or whatever, and just to the way Google searches for ad opportunities, you search for dollars, you get dollars. You don't even have to be good anymore. Once you've got that position, you're set for life. You're like this new kind of king. Or it might be the Google-like position of routing ads. But everybody wants to be at the top of this network, but nobody wants to actually do anything. And ultimately, all we're doing is chewing on our own bones if we don't actually do this stuff. Because, you know, you can search all you like, but if you're not making stuff to be searched for, you know, it dies. And if you can make all the financial schemes you want, but if you're not doing real work to earn the money, eventually the bubble bursts. And they're exactly the same principle. And
we're in a new bubble, if you will.
I think we're sort of in a weird fake personage bubble or something, which from a technical point of view is implemented exactly in the same way as the real estate bubble. You know, it's just the wrong way to use a computer network. You should use a computer network to represent reality so you do a better job in your real world actions. A computer network is the only way to study global warming because it's a global phenomenon. You need to measure it and study it globally. One more thing that has to be said is that what's happening to musicians and newspapers now eventually happens to everything and everybody for the simple reason that technology is still getting better. And eventually, let's say, if a robot can make t-shirts very cheaply from designs from the internet, you'll no longer be able to tell a musician, well, give away the music, but sell the t-shirt, because then the t-shirts will become free too. And you can sort of see
you're always being chased by free.
Yeah. Free can follow you no matter what you do. There's no such thing as some carpenter or some, you know, like there are all these fantasies about these people who will escape it. Ultimately, you have to admit that creativity is worth something if you want to have a long-term creative survival of the human race. Otherwise, you'll kill it. And that very simple thing is something we've got to learn to see. We've got to cut through the stupid ideology of the open culture movement and all this stuff. It's just a big mistake. It was an interesting, noble mistake. I was part of it, but it's really wrong.
You point out that technology changes people and that minute changes in the design of a technology can have far-reaching behavioral impact.
Yeah, well, that's the strangest thing, that digital gadgets tend to be so hard to use that if you just make a slight change to the usability of them, you can completely transform people's habits. For instance, the difference between having a service like, Facebook or Twitter and not having them from a technical point of view is unbelievably minute, because anybody who wasn't just absolutely lazy could always do exactly the same stuff easily. I mean, this is like so...
That's technology.
It's just like sort of
we can repeat
a
it again and again.
In fact, I have to say, I mean, I remember some things that we used to just do, just to screw around at places like the Stanford AI Lab, going back to the
80s. The artificial intelligence lab, yeah.
Exactly, that were like Twitter or Facebook, but better. You know, like we used to, like that kind of stuff is not hard to spin out, and anybody could do that. But what's happened is instead of doing what Craig Newmark did and just like adding a little layer to help people organize things and not expecting much for it, just doing something to help the world, instead they've added these businesses add a little tiny layer and then sort of suck all these people into it, because by adding that little bit of ease of use, it just influences an enormous number of people, especially the non-geeky ones.
Right.
The geeky ones remain free, but the non-geeky ones get trapped by these like small improvements in usability. And the weird thing in this case is that they're not even making any money like they want to. Facebook would love to be the next Google, but the truth is the way you make money with advertising is with the I hate to use this word, but it's sort of a natural monopoly, which is the exchange that unites advertisers with opportunities. And even if you have a better way of finding those things, once you have that momentum, it's very hard. It's like trying to start a new eBay. You sort of can't, because everybody's already committed to that one. So Google's kind of got a lock on that thing. So all the Web 2.0 businesses, the Facebooks and the Twitters, can make a little bit of money by joining forces with the big players, but basically they're kind of stumps, you know, as businesses, and so they've changed the culture for this hope that doesn't even get fulfilled. So it's just irony upon irony, and I think a great shame.
Actually, I actually love the anti-advertisement movement, where you go out there like on Wikispaces or one of these places, and you can get all these services for free, and they have Google Ads down the side, and then for $5 a month, they'll take away the Google ads.
So it's like, yeah.
Well, that's kind of interesting.
2,500 years ago, there's recorded a joke in ancient Greece where some musicians, some buskers in the Agora are playing, and for one drachma they'll play, and for two they'll stop playing.
Yeah.
And the problem with that, if it's just a couple of musicians in one place on the Agora, that's fine. But if it becomes this universal feature, then it becomes into this sort of ambient blackmail that everybody has to be part of, and that's really not okay. If I wanted to be liked, I wouldn't say the things I say because I know they upset a lot of people. And a lot of people I care about, a lot of people who are close to me.
And what's upsetting them?
Well, a lot of people have adopted this sort of amalgam of the Web 2.0 stuff and the open culture stuff and the singularity in some cases. They've adopted that as their new sort of set of touchstones for meaning in their lives, very much as, oh, I don't know, in the 60s, a lot of people were expecting the psychedelic revolution to cure all the ills of humanity or any other examples like that. It's just because they care about these for their context. When I attack them, they feel as if I'm attacking
them.
Yeah, I guess so. And it's a shame, but I don't know what to do because the stuff is really wrong. It's really bad.
It's how you see it, and that's your job as an individual. Now, you did mention the singularity, and of course, Ray Kurzweil is the great purporter of the singularity, mm-hmm. much talked about in cyber circles. What's the singularity, and what do you find wrong with the concept?
Oh, well, the singularity is an idea that the machines will start designing other machines, and then because they'll get better and better, it'll happen so quickly that in a blink of an eye, they'll get way, way smarter than us.
And they have consciousness.
And they'll be conscious, but they'll maybe love us, and so they'll scoop up all our consciousnesses and give us eternal life within some big machine or something. And there are all kinds of different versions of the singularity, and I've been arguing about the singularity since I was a little kid. The singularity has taken on the role of a religious element to computer science. Somebody's got to just say it. Somebody's just got to speak clearly about it. And no one's doing it, so I just have to do it.
Now, this is your first book. How is the experience going out of it, having written it, different from your expectations going in?
Well, you have to understand that I was trying to write a book for like a quarter century or more. For a while, I had the distinction of having the most overdue book contract in the New York publishing world, which is something like over 20 years. And they finally said, okay, look, just forget it. But what got me to finally do it was just alarm. Because I'd been wanting to write a book that said approximately what this book says, but I wanted to write it in the 80s, and I tried to. And all kinds of people tried to help me write it. There's this whole, it could be a whole soap opera in itself. And I was just always so busy and caught up in the moment and running around doing things that, like, sitting down to finish a book was impossible. And two things changed. One is I had a kid, so I had to change my life. So instead of running around the way you're supposed to in the post-intellectual property world, I had to kind of stay around. And so it gave me the texture with which to actually write something big. But also, I just am so appalled that we could be this wonderful country and this wonderful technological community could be essentially embracing poverty and embracing what I think is an undignified future, and I just had to write this.
For years, people say, oh, Jaron coined the term virtual reality, and somebody would say, well, I don't know if he coined it, but he certainly popularized it. And I thought, oh, well, great, let's see what your website says. And your website says that you either coined or popularized the term virtual reality. It's like, you don't even know.
Well, how could I know? I mean, I don't have omniscience, I don't have I remember coining it, but the thing is, it could have, maybe someone else coined it too. I don't know. There's one earlier instance I know about, which is the French theater visionary Antonin Artaud has it in French as a passing part of a phrase describing the theater in a book that's obviously much, much earlier, almost 100 years ago now. And
so this is how you get out of the controversy. It's like, well, maybe I remember when I thought of it. Yeah.
The thing is, the people who don't like what I say want to pick apart any little thing like that. And the truth is, who cares? So I just figured instead of arguing about it, I would just say I either coined it or popularized it. And
you didn't just popularize it. I mean, you had a whole company on virtual reality.
No,
you
built it.
Patents.
I mean,
you made it happen very early on.
My group at VPL, a wonderful collection of oddballs when we were kids, made the first avatars and the first shared virtual worlds and the first well, a bunch. We did a bunch of stuff first, and but those firsts are in a way trivial compared to the applications, because the stuff that really excited me back then was doing things like the first real-time surgical simulations and stuff that really, I think, had an impact. And there's a certain school of thought that since I, Jaron, I've become this turncoat against the movement, and I'm a traitor, that somehow my reputation must be picked apart now. But I'm still able to work with people even if they don't share my view on the big picture. So I just keep working.
More of the same. More of the same.
No, it's wonderful.
Sounds like a good plan.
Technology is such an astonishing thing. It's a way that people can make the future better than the past. And what an astonishing thing that we happen to exist in a universe where that's possible. I mean, it's so remarkable, and we often forget what an astonishing situation we have.
Well, Jaron, don't be a stranger. Loved having you on. Come back again.
Anytime. I'm just over in Berkeley, you know, so.
My guest today is Jaron Lanier. The book is You Are Not a Gadget, a Manifesto. It's published by Knopf. More information about this interview is available at www.technation.com. For TechNation, I'm Moira Gunn.
You've been listening to the IT Conversations podcast edition of TechNation with Dr. Moira Gunn. Most editions of TechNation are recorded at the studios of KQED in San Francisco. TechNation is also available on over 200 public radio stations throughout the United States, as well as on Armed Forces Radio. Please check your local listings for time and availability.